While everybody's coming in, I want to spend just a minute to tell you about the book that we brought with us. For several years, Tom and I have done marriage workshops around the country, and we would take a handout for everybody to make notes on. And as usually happened, we would each workshop would be a little bit different, and we'd cover some of the material at one workshop. We'd cover some plus a little bit at another, and we never really could give everybody the same amount of information or the same information each time. So we had people ask us, do you have a book or do you have videotapes or something we can have in our church library, something that we can take back with us? And we'd say, alas, no, we don't. Sorry. We also had, we would have phone calls from people who would say, we want to do a Wednesday night class for our couples at church and wonder if you have any material that you could recommend we use as an outline for Bible class on marriage with our couples. And I know there's some good stuff there, but as far as my knowing what was available that would be appropriate for class time, we really didn't know what to do for that. We also had preachers and elders in small congregations in rural areas who had never been trained in counseling, but they had couples in their congregations who needed help. They didn't have the resources available in their town to refer people to. And so all those things kind of came together with us that we decided to write a book that would give not only information, be educational, it would also be experiential in the way that it's a workbook. It's an informational workbook. And it's great for Bible classes, a Wednesday night series. We actually did this material with Wednesday nights with couples at the University Church in Abilene where we attend. And we had a great time with it. And the couples seemed to really enjoy doing that. So it's helpful to use in that way. We've had preachers use it in their counseling sessions with their couples because it gives a framework, an organization, and the skills that we don't have an opportunity to teach you this weekend. There are exercises in there, explanations on how to do them, and there's everything from communication, problem solving, commitment, family of origin things, sexuality, being your best self. How you become a stronger you, so you're better in, you make you're a better partner for that relationship. And it's filled with scriptures that apply to each of these areas and lots of fun things to do in it. So that's what this book is about. And if you're interested in getting one, they're $20, and that covers our cost and in tax. And you might want to get one to have either for your library or to use personally. It's a lot cheaper than a toaster if you have somebody getting married. They're good wedding, books for married couples. And so that's why we brought this, because we've had so many people have different needs for it, and we designed it especially for those kinds of uses. We also designed it so it's particularly husband-friendly. And I don't want to be stereotypical about guys, because most of my work has actually been working with men. I know that men are just as interested in family, are just as moved, and just as easily hurt by family problems, but they haven't been socialized to really feel as comfortable to ask for help or to do therapy or go for therapy as women are much more likely to do that. So we tried to make it husband-friendly as well as interesting and helpful for the wives. And so that's what that is, and that's just a plug in case you all are interested in getting one. We wanted to bring that for you to have to consider.
Let me take that to another level, and that's about the contracting and developing weekend workshops. Do about 5 minutes. Most of this comes from when we get contacted. I found that it may be a deacon, it may be somebody on the Family Life Committee, but if they haven't really done or like what you've experienced today, is the product of an awful lot of work. I think you've probably figured that out. Great venue. The food doesn't just happen. If we had babysitting, that wouldn't just happen. The PR doesn't just happen. The folks putting together the materials doesn't just happen. So enough said about that. But I recommend, particularly in Texas, and especially if it's in the fall, do not have Friday night workshops. I mean, nobody's going to come, and you're going to just make people feel guilty. So if you wanted to have a guilt workshop, you could do it when there's a home football game. It's not, you know, you're just not going to change the culture. It's part of the place we live in. I asked that same question if somebody in Austin wanted to have me. You know, what's happening on the weekend, or if it's Chattanooga, or any of the places where there are a lot of competing events. I prefer that we do our workshop on one day. We started out doing a Friday night, go 7 to 10, and then do a morning through noon on Saturday. What we found is that you'll have folks that'll come on Friday night and not come on Saturday, not because the program's not any good, but they supported the effort, they just didn't show on the second time. So I think it's easier to let people know. Plus, if you're doing with Merrill kinds of things, you're doing a babysitting issue, and if it's at a venue like this, then you can provide babysitting. They come and they start, feed them lunch, and then you can be through by 2:30 or 3 o'clock, and they're committing a block of time, and so you get people to come in. I would encourage you to have people stay over and do maybe a Bible class, or if you want someone to preach on the theme. And I will tell you that every time I've stayed over on a Sunday and done either the class or the sermon, you invariably will have people say, well, now, why are you here? Oh, I wish I'd known. And you go, well, we've only been announcing it for the last 6 months, you know. So what you do are get to those people who would come to a workshop, and then because they'll usually show up for Sunday, then you at least get another shot at them for free. If you want to do a workshop away at a retreat setting, obviously you jack the cost up a little bit. It's a little more complicated, but it does pull people away from sort of their normal natural environment and let them focus on something. Most couples do not want to go to a retreat setting, sit and listen to some talking heads all the time. So you need to have some fun activities, some team building. They'll get as much from, if you will, the co-curricular activity as they'll get from the resource people that you bring in. Most congregations are trying to do one sort of booster session a year for family, something that's nice. And I'm sorry, this sounds a little cynical, but they're kind of pep rallies. You're not really doing life-changing events. Remember our fellowship? We're the ones that couldn't make it from Sunday to Sunday, so we invented Wednesday nights. Right. So we already said you can't make it without a, you know, midweek booster session. Some of you are old enough to remember we used to call it prayer meeting, right? So anyway, so the notion is, yeah, we'd like to have people excited. Our commitment doing workshops is we always want to do a workshop where it would not keep somebody from going to the next one. That ought to be fun, inviting, invigorating, and so we don't put people in any compromising situations. We don't make them do anything that they would not be comfortable doing. It's not, you're all going to have to go back to room 6, sit around, hold hands, and tell the worst thing that's ever happened in your marriage. We're just not going to do that because that's not, one, it's not very professional or ethical, and two, it's just bad business. So, we want to continue these kind of top 10, throw in some other material that would help. And just a brief comment about unrealistic expectations. An activity that you can do to help people discover their expectations is that each one of them, he would do this list, she would do this list, and it's very simple. Write down 10 things that describe what a good husband is or does. So I would do my list. Sandra would do a list. Here's what a good husband is or does. We don't do these together. You do your list. I don't cheat and look at yours. So we've got two separate lists. Then, what a good wife is or does. Again, what a good wife is or does. Now we have two lists about a good husband and two lists about a good wife. Then we want to compare those lists. The notion being that if I have a rule set, so here's what a good husband is or does. These would be behaviors attitudes, activities, those sorts of things. And I'm living up to that. And I give myself a B plus, maybe an A minus, because I'm also humble, and that's on my list. But I look at her list, and none of the stuff that I'm doing is on her list, and I'm getting a C minus D, something like that. So what we're looking for is, well, here's what a role description is. Now let me ask you, where do we get the notion about what a good husband or wife is or does? Where do we develop those notions?
Parents.
From our parents, from the culture, from them periodically. Well, one of the things I always hope in my marital stuff is that the husband and wife have a different set of parents. I used to just hope they were from different genders, and now that's kind of, anyway, that was a late afternoon joke. But the notion that you come from different families. Now, you look at or think about your relationship without creating any damage on a Saturday afternoon. There are some things that your family did differently than the other's family did. And it may be that their family is a little weird because they did some really goofy stuff. But our family did it right. Well, now on the other side of the coin, their family's doing it right, and you're living with the weird folks. Our job as husband and wife is to blend those two, and that's called family of origin, family where you started out. We came together, and now we have to blend it. So you let them see each other's lists and see if they can then come up with a common list of here's what a good husband is or does. Two qualifiers for this exercise. Many of the things that are there are going to be called instrumental activities. I went to the store the other night. I put gasoline in her car. Not that she can't do gasoline. You do it most of the time, but I thought, well, I'm out. I'll put gasoline. That's an instrumental task. Taking the trash out, cooking a meal, vacuuming, cleaning the house, going and getting a job. Being a good provider. If you were to ask most men, what's the thing that a good husband does is he has a job, right? He's a good provider. Now, they don't ask what is the cost associated with being a good provider. So you have instrumental tasks. Both men and women do those. The other set of tasks are called expressive. Expressive. This is more of the affect or the emotional end of that. A good spouse is a loving spouse, is supportive, is communicative. These are more traits than they are activities.
It's good when you're helping couples come up with those lists that you help them be specific about what that means. A good husband is supportive. So what does that mean exactly? If I was a fly on the wall, how would I know that your husband was being supportive? Because that's a kind of a vague, we can put things in vague terms and never have to really put them in black and white. So it's important for you to kind of nudge them in the direction of being very specific so the husband will know when he has actually done that. Because most spouses try their best to meet whatever expectations the other one has. But if they don't know for sure what that is, you can really work hard trying to meet it and never do it. So making them
A good husband loves their spouse. Well, yes, but what does that look like? Let me put it in a little different context. Let's say it's in the morning. You've extended the invitation. Someone comes down the center of the aisle and sits and fills out a card and says, the things that I would like the eldership to help me with is to be a better Christian. Now you tell me what that means. Well, if they came and said, be a stronger Christian, you could say, well, the weight room is over in the gym. Every Monday morning we do aerobics, yoga, and powerlifting. Hope that program. So you are already doing things. If they came and said, we want to be a stronger, better, those kind of nondescript things, say, we'd be glad to help you. Is Monday evening a good time for two of us to come by and visit with you, and then we're going to delineate what that means? Or however that would come. Is that making some sense. If I came and did a consult with your congregation and you said, one of the things that we want to do over the next 12 months is have a more spiritual congregation. Given the conversation we've had in the last 3 minutes, I would tell you, you don't know what that means operationally. And so we'd have to come to an agreement of what that would mean. Some it might mean we're all going to read through the Bible in the next 12 months. Some would mean we're going to convert X number of people. We're going to be involved in Y number of missionary things. So there's a level of specificity that's involved, particularly in the Christian expression, that spills over into our relationship areas. And so expectations, you could also have them do what a good marriage looks like. Here are my expectations. Now, the notion of unrealistic expectations is if they're really unrealistic, they're not going to be met. And when your expectations go unmet, you're going to become disgruntled. You're going to get dissatisfied. In fact, you may do things in an attempt to get your unrealistic expectations met. What would come to mind for you as an unrealistic expectation that you see or aware of in folks? I mean, it's just kind of, that's not going to happen. Anything come to mind? Maybe even from your own marriage.
What?
Okay, it's always, we're always going to love each other. We'll never have a crossword. You know, one of the things that I encourage folks is just go and have a crossword in front of your kids so they'll know you're normal. Now, that's not an argument or a fight. Our kids would come in, are y'all getting a divorce? No, we're having a discussion about, But I was doing a workshop once, and at the break, a guy came down. He was pretty angry. He looked like me. I just want you to know my wife and I have been married 45 years, and we've never had a crossword. And I almost said, well, how long has she been dead? Because I didn't know that was really a good thing. I understand not having a, fist fight sort of thing, but normal human. See, part of this condition is two selfish individuals living together for 50 plus years. I mean, that's kind of a hard trick, isn't it? So when we bring in mentor couples to work with younger couples, we just finished a go-round of that at the university church. I think there were 8 or 10, maybe college age, newly married kinds of folks paired with senior couples. I don't want them paired with a couple that's never had any problems because they're delusional. Well, I didn't think we had a problem. Let me tell you the people that show up in, what a deer in the headlight looks, That's the guy just got the divorce papers and had no clue anything was wrong. And they'll go out and buy our book now, and he'll bring it home and go, you need to read this. She says, I've already got a copy. It's one you didn't read. So we have all those kinds of issues under unrealistic expectations.
A social exchange theory would say profit equals cost minus rewards or rewards minus cost. So if you have, if somebody doesn't think they're getting enough out of this relationship, it's costing them more than they're getting out of it. And so the profit would be low in that situation. Perhaps they're wanting this much, and that's not a possibility. They can moderate down. It's okay to lower your expectations. That's not the American way, but sometimes it's appropriate to do that. We may be expecting too much from the other person, and it's very comforting to realize that it's okay to lower your expectations, and it's not going to be the end of the world. Okay.
All right, the next one has to do with sexual relations or sexual relationships. Piece of advice. Run. Do not walk away from those discussions. Unless you have some training well beyond what most individuals would have, the dealing with erectile dysfunction, premature ejaculation, vaginismus, all of those kinds of things, you really don't need to get involved in. Is that clear enough? You need to run, not get involved. Or say, we'll be glad to get you to somebody that can take care of that. Most of the sexual issues that you can deal with, I think of as neck up. the things that go on in your head. One of the issues that I think makes ministry couples or elders or ministers specifically vulnerable is that you're going to have to establish some real clear boundaries about who you see, when you see, where you see people. Never, ever see an individual of the opposite sex alone. Clear enough today? Never, ever. Don't make house calls. If you do, take somebody with you. Go, you know, the joy bus pulls up full of people to go have do that. Don't show up. Quite often you may have the best, let's hope all of the time, have the best of intentions, but you don't know what lurks in the mind of the other individual. It's just not worth the risk.
And men of power or women of power or authority have a way of being, for a weaker person, being very attractive. And so you're in a position where that can be very easily, unintentionally used or abused by whoever's coming to you for help. And so it's just not safe. If you're in an office, leave the door cracked a little bit. That's our minister does that without fail. There are people walking around, but he has a crack in the door when a lady comes to see him. And that's very, very smart.
Yeah, by that I mean, Eddie, for instance, will be in office doing session with a woman, but there are two or three or four armed guards outside, secretaries, killer attack, you know, kinds of people. There's somebody always there. They're not at the opposite end of the building. You know, there's somebody that's right there. It does not mean anything is going to happen. Are you trying to prevent something? It's just the professional, bright way to do it. Now, the kind of sexual relations issues that I think congregations need to begin to address may be better dealt with in same-sex groups. For instance, have all the men get together and bring somebody in to talk about internet pornography or just pornography in general. It makes a really interesting Wednesday night kind of deal. On a Wednesday night before Christmas, Sandra and I went and did a pornography piece, and I'm thinking timing in the Church of Christ is just interesting stuff. I don't know, maybe it works better in a summer. But would it be fair to say that the issue of pornography in general, but especially internet pornography, is has a relative presence in our culture? If you want to scare yourself, take all the filters off and just kind of ferret about, and you'll unplug the whole thing to do that. I will tell you, your kids know where the good sites are. It doesn't take a lot of hunting. My observation about Church of Christ folks is that because we know the scripture about the divorce, the scriptural reason for divorce is sexual infidelity, right? If I haven't had physical contact with somebody else, then it doesn't count, right? So I can use pornography for mental affairs, thus avoiding sort of the cardinal sin notion. So we have people come into our practice and say, well, you know, I've never been unfaithful. What they mean is we've never had sexual intercourse, but they've been unfaithful in all of those other areas. I'm not trying to do a theological position, but I tell you, there's a lot of rationalization in the pew in terms of what goes on. When men have affairs that are in secret, they're probably not going to come to the leadership. They're not going to come to the ministers. While it's going on, they're going to come after it's been disclosed. So then you have an opportunity to talk about sexual behavior and the sexualization of stuff. Brief observation that when you have, and most men that have affairs have them with women, and so that means that the woman then is having an affair with a man. Would it be fair to say then that women see sexuality in affairs not as the primary concern, because I'm not just going to have sex with you unless I'm in love with you? Would that be fair? Maybe not 100%, but somewhat. So one of the things when you're trying to untangle these affair issues, it is that, well, he may not be quite as invested in the relationship as she is. And so when they throw the, well, we have to be in love to legitimize our fleshly desires, then it just gets more complicated.
One of the things that I'm going to leave up here on the table for you to copy, and I'm sorry I didn't know to I pulled this out at the last minute. I have some assessment instruments that you can get off the internet. Internet sex screening test, and there's a sexual addiction screening test, and then another link, and there is a bibliography of some good books for folks that will help work with people who might be suffering with a sexual addiction. There's a really good book called Every Man's Battle that's an excellent resource to have. I don't have the name of that author. But these are things, if you want to have them, if you know of people. We did this in a congregation on Wednesday night before Christmas because they were having difficulty in that congregation with, it was a very public thing, problem with pornography on the internet. And so these are some resources you can copy down to take with you and use later, and I'll leave them right up there. But as far as working with couples, when Tom said most of the things are neck up issues, because of our culture, a lot of times we're more vulnerable to affairs or whatever. And I always like the quote from Einstein. His first wife asked him, "What happened to us?" Because they were so in love at the beginning. And he said, his career had really gone crazy, and he was doing so much and so famous. He said, "It's hard to play a violin in the evening when you've worked with a heavy hammer all day." We all work with heavy hammers, most of us, all day long. And so to switch gears when we get home and relax and enjoy each other physically, it's very difficult. And a lot of times we get sucked in that hammer work with somebody else working with a hard hammer. We get into affairs in the workplace with people we have more in common with because we're so invested there. So helping couples figure out what's important, prioritizing that relationship, and being able to spend more time with each other, having emotional energy left over in the evening, is a very important part of helping them maintain that.
Let me ask if there are any questions about that, or observations or rebuts. In your congregation in the last 5 years, have you had any incidences of sexual infidelity? You think it's because they didn't know it was wrong? I think everybody pretty well. You know, if you've been to two or three church services, got that one figured out. I think that the notion in the preventive aspect is, what can you do to keep yourself out of those situations? Accountability is one, I think, excellent way. I have some friends in ministry that travel a lot, and on a couple of those, the congregation has made arrangements for someone to travel with that person, not because they, don't trust the individual, but that's just one of the ways they kind of take care of each other. Travel is a sort of unruly beast. In most motel rooms now, you have access to pornography through the television connection. One of the things that makes home computers, I think, put a bump into this is the sense of anonymity. You don't have to drive anywhere. You don't have to go to the triple, quadruple X store and figure out a place to park and hope you don't see anybody or do any of those. You can do that right in your own home. Some individuals will say, "You can come look at the history of my web activity anytime you want. I'm not going to put it on a clean it out every 20 seconds sort of deal. I'll leave it up there for whatever your computer software will handle. You can come and look at where I've been whenever you want to." So you have those kinds of issues. The next one has to do with decision making and problem solving, and this will make you, in the next 10 minutes, excellent therapist. The handout that's in your book on how to become one, if you'll look at Roman numeral 7, a model for mutual decision making, this will be an outline for what we're going to do. Remember this morning I mentioned, hope that you would learn to ask elegant or excellent questions. These are then going to be the 10 questions. This model not only works in a counseling setting, but it also works in a corporate setting, any large system setting, your own individual decision-making things. All couples have to make decisions. Can't get away from that. Decisions that are made well strengthen the relationship. Decisions that are not made so well over time become problems. And a problem left unattended over time becomes a conflict, whether that's at a congregational level all the way down to the individual level. So you can think of this as, well, we've got a problem or we have a conflict, but we're really going to go down to dealing with how to make good decisions. Decisions that individuals make are not nearly as complicated until they become couple decisions, because now you've got two players in this, or the more players you have, the more complicated things are. And I think as congregational leaders, you already know that. I remember walking, I was serving as an elder at the Highland Church when this happened, to walk across the parking lot, and an individual came up and said, well, I want to know, you know, when you guys decided to do that and why we didn't get to vote. And the only thing that came to my mind was, well, the church isn't a democracy. You know, hopefully it's a benevolent dictatorship, but it's I think that's one of the hazards when you do surveys. People think they're votes. Now, if you want to vote on stuff, that's fine. But anyway, and I'll just throw this in. Your congregation thinks that you dedicate one meeting a month to coming up with really dumb decisions. I mean, you must. How could that many smart folks come up with that stupid thing? Right? I mean, now as parents, your children think you spend multiple days coming up with these dumb ideas. It's always a great thing in doing family therapy is to ask the kids, you know, what's an example of a dumb rule your parents? Why don't I just ask you, when you were the kid at home, what was an example of a really dumb rule your parents had? Who'd like to share? 5 minutes on the phone. Okay, and that's a dumb rule. Think of what that done to the cell phone industry. I mean, you can't drive now unless you're got one of these. Another dumb rule. Make your bed every day. I'm just going to get in it again tonight and make it mess it up again. All right? Yes. Every kid should just like go away and show up when they want. Let me ask you this question. If your kids were here, what would they say were some of the dumb, stupid rules you cooked up? Same ones, because they got
smarter, didn't they?
Yeah. So you could go and ask your congregation on that next survey, what's the stupidest thing the elders have done in the last 12 months? But you're not going to do that, and that'd probably be rather threatening. Ask me this question on a survey. That was one of the dumb things you did. Most of what I've noticed about human beings is the rules we like, we don't gripe about. The rules we don't like, we think are stupid, right? Same thing in relationships. You know, why do we have to do that? Because I said so. So we're going to do the 10 steps of mutual decision making. Number one, and you have to do these in order. It doesn't work if you don't do them in order. You've heard Randy actually steal part of this. This morning you heard, if you were in here to hear Judy and Charles Seibert a while ago, they did a little of a modification under the word GROW. Number one, what's the issue? What are we talking about? This works, you know, if you've got a disgruntled church member, you can ask them, well, you know, if there are conflicts with you, what are we really talking about? When I was preaching in Lubbock a number of years ago, whenever we do a responsive reading, I knew without 100% of the time in the foyer when I'm working the crowd, this lady would come out and say, thank you for that Catholic service. And we're just doing a responsive reading. You're more than welcome. You know, what are we talking about? Have you been in a discussion where you started out talking on something and you wound up over on something else? You got off topic. So if you think of this issue as the hub, it's that thing that's going to anchor the rest of these. For instance, if I said to you, the issue is how to have more money in your savings account, you could do that. The issue is how to have a comma in your savings account. Well, thought that'd do a little bit better, but you have a comma in your savings account already, obviously, a retired group. Okay. Not in higher Christian education. What about if the couple were saying, spend more time together as a couple? Have more of a quality relationship. Whatever it is, the next thing we're going to do, number two, is come up with the facts. If I said we were going to have more money in our savings account, what would be the facts that I would be interested in? All right, how much do I make and how would I know that? Well, Friday, no. Was it Friday you should have known that? Or what you make should have matched the 15th state. That's pretty easy to know, isn't it? What else would you want to know? Okay, how much are you currently saving? You might want to know how much is in your savings account right now. And how would you find that out? This is a slow group. How would you find out how much money is in your savings account? Call the bank. Savings account, that's what... You'd call the bank. How hard would it be to argue over how much money the bank said you had in the savings account? Shouldn't be too hard. Now, you could argue why it is or why it's not. But our issue is to have more money in our savings account. If it was we want to spend more time together as a couple, what kind of facts would we generate about that? How much time have we spent together in the last month or 2 months or 3 months or 4 months? I wouldn't go back too far. And how would you know that? Would all the players have the same memory? No. So one of the hazards of facts is there's going to be objective information and subjective information. Objective information and subjective information. Randy this morning, when he was talking about Scripture and interpretation thereof, was talking specifically, although he didn't use those words, about the objective information is the text. Everybody can read these same words, but the subjective part he talked about his interpretation. I might talk about is your interpretation and the emotion that goes along with it. Had a client, we're talking about she said, we never go on a date. And he said, well, I brought you to therapy, didn't I? You know, I didn't think that really qualified as a date. How much time do we spend together? You know, does going to the grocery store count or not count? So you're beginning to look about those particular kinds of things. When I purchase a car, there are things that I look at that are objective. What would those be? Guys? Women? Price, engine displacement, gear ratio, speed, mileage, injected, not injected, all those vroom vroom stuff.
Be careful.
Women can look at that. Not you, but women.
If I wanted to, I could.
And see, where I was going with this is I used to think that I was all heady. And she said, no, you care what color it is. And that's true. Most of what I have is red. Down to the lawnmower is red. My weed eater's red. My shaver's red. You know. So... But we bought a house, and her comment was, I don't like that wallpaper. People will think it's me. I'm thinking, I don't know you've ever been mistaken for wallpaper.
The ladies know what I meant.
Right? But that's subjective and just as important.
Well, objectively, money in the bank would be what the bank statement says. Subjectively, it's either enough or not enough. So how much does the bank say? X amount of dollars is an objective fact. Subjectively, we want more in there. That's not enough. So that would be the subjective fact.
I've been wanting less in there. So I've been working on that. Yeah. Issue, facts. Think about church arguments. What's really the issue, right? Now, just as an aside to you as leaders, I think one of the things we have to be careful about is when we implement things that we've been studying for the last year or two, and then we come to a decision to do it. It's a mistake if you do it immediately without giving the congregation the 2 years of lead time and study time that you took. Does that make some sense? That'd be for another day. I see a lot of elderships crash and burn because they'll study something, come to a decision, and then force feed it onto a congregation who's had no lead time to get ready for it. So there's timing kinds of issues. So we got issue and facts. Next thing we've got is our opinion about the facts. Everybody's going to have an opinion or a theory about the meaning of the facts. All right, we agree there's X amount of money. We agree that there's Y. So if you're going to have a larger congregation in 12 months, it could be larger by one. That's larger, depends on how you define it. So we have a theory, or why, if it went up or it went down, or why do we need to have it? So it's a great discussion point, theory. The fourth one is, what emotion do I have now that I've got the facts and the theory sort of laid out? Everybody's going to have an emotion. So to recap, we have an issue that we're talking about. We have facts about it. We have a theory or an opinion about those facts. And now we have an emotion. They sit in front of me and they're not getting along very well. And we have developed the notion that for the last 4 or 5 months, he has been staying at work longer. He's been working some Saturdays. He, in fact, has worked some Sunday afternoons. He's not been as available to the wife and to the kids as he had been previously. And they have different theories about him being gone. Her theory is that he no longer loves her and that he has probably developed a relationship with another woman. His theory is that as a junior partner in the CPA firm, that it's tax season and he's been doing people's taxes. Do their theories, are they slightly divergent? Based on the same facts, but they wound up at different places. Do you think their emotions would be different? Absolutely. So one of the things that one can do is change your interpretation of the fact. Oh, yeah, it's tax season. That makes a whole lot of difference. And then you would change their affect. It's very hard to get affect from some people. There are some people, if you ask them what how they feel about something, they may tell you what they think about it. Does that make some sense? Okay, let me use it a little bit different way. If I ask you, what emotion do you have about a particular event, it's harder for you to tell me what's going on in your head.
Harder or easier?
I'm sorry, what did I say?
You said harder.
Did I?
It's easier to tell you what's going on in your head.
It's easier to tell me what's going on. Yes, that's what I meant to say. I'm glad that was a shared meaning. Thank you, that was good. If I ask you what emotion you have, I'm going to tell you what's in my heart. If I ask you your opinion, I'll get what's in your head. Does that make, did I say that right? Okay. A lot of the church difficulties that we struggle with in the leadership, I think, are issues of the heart, not of the head. I think they're emotional, visceral kinds of things, and really not formed in a lot of logic. I grew up in my mother. I got a Bible for Christmas when I was a kid, and it had a zipper around it. And the pull on the zipper was a cross. And my mother took the pliers and cut the cross off the zipper so no one would mistake me for a Catholic. It worked. No one mistook me for a Catholic, a very weird Campbellite. But do you know people that would have an affinity? They just get cranked up if they came in Sunday, and you may have one, but had a large cross up behind the pulpit. Would they? I mean, they'd go, what? That must have been the meeting last month. Those guys flipped out. Where is this going? We've had, did you look in the parking lot? There's the back end of a camel got his nose stuck in the front door. Where are we? They're visceral. I mean, they're emotional. You know, and so we're all kind of like that, even in marriage. You want to throw anything in?
I was going to say that usually, if we had a visual picture for you to see the issue, the facts, the emotion about it, the theory about it, and then the emotion, what we usually do is go straight from the issue to the emotional part, and we forget to do the work, the steps to that. It's easier just to, you know, go off instead of doing that little extra work to figure out what's really going on.
So you're sitting at a table with another couple, and they're complaining about something. And so the thing about which they're complaining is the issue, and all you're asking them, well, let's see if we can't generate some information about this. And so you just put that on. Then you'd ask each of them, well, how do you interpret this? This isn't an easel with a butcher paper kind of deal. You can just simply ask them those questions. Man, when all this is going on, what's your heart saying to you? What words come to mind to describe your emotional state? And so you might get a series of words from one. You might not get anything from some. Oh, no. This is where a scaling technique would help you a lot. And you can use a scaling technique in a lot of your clinical work or your counseling, mentoring work if you want to. Scaling is just simply, well, when you think about not having enough time together as a couple, one is you feel really, 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 really awful. And when you think about spending time together as a couple and you're ecstatic, Roman candles and skyrockets, you're a 10. So from really awful to just, whoo, is it 1 to a 10? What would that make a 5? Well, I don't know. That's exactly right. It's in the middle. It's not quite positive and it's not quite negative. Now, the wives that are here right now listening to this are going, oh, if I got you, wait till I get you home. Because I'm going to ask you what affect you have going, and now you're going to have to tell me. Oh, you're a 4. Good. That's great. Next time you have a vote at the elders' meeting, scale the vote from 1 to 10 and make them sign it. How would that go? Fewer elders, right? You know, we're going to vote. Have you ever seen a yes that looked like a 4. You know, raise your hand if you're for that. What if you made a deal that the average, well, averages, those of you that are mathematical may not like that, but you had to kind of like have a 7, 7.5 before you really did something. Let's say you want to buy X number of acres to build a new bill, and everybody that's in favor of that, wouldn't you like to know a little bit more than everybody that's in favor of that? Maybe not. I have some land in Abilene I'd like to sell you for your building. So we have the issue, we have the facts, we have the theory, we have the emotion. Now we're going to come up with a goal. A goal question needs to be specific. I'd like for it to be behavioral. If we had enough money in the bank, what would you like for that to be? If we were going to spend enough time together, what would that look like? If we were going to do this, it'd be as specific as possible. They're not going to like you when you push them toward being specific because it's going to help nail down some stuff. I wish my spouse were more supportive of me. Well, what would that look like specifically? Well, then you're going to know whether they are or they aren't. Now, 6 through 10 are basically how you generate alternatives. You evaluate those alternatives. You select one. You do it for enough time to see if it's going to work. Short enough time that if it's not working, do something else. And that's what number 10 then is, the evaluative process. I use this on a daily basis with clients to work through what the issues are, what the information in the background is, where their head is, where their heart is, where they want to go, and really what they want to do. They're easy for you to remember because you have 10 fingers, hopefully, unless it's your finger in the Wendy's chili. Now we'll find out. So whatever the issue is, facts, theory, feeling, goals, that takes care of 5. Then we've got generate things that you could do to accomplish the goal. Evaluate those. Some of them are going to have more payoff than others. Choose one of them. Do it for a while. See how it worked. 10 elegant questions. Okay?
Yep.
I think we've done the demonstration of affection with the kiss, unless you want to say something.
The warming up behaviors.
Okay, we can do that.
How much time we have?
We got 14 minutes.
Okay, something that's, when couples are not having their, usually the emotions, things are not going well with the family, with the couple, and it's because we talked about they're not having their needs met, the rewards are, it's costing, the relationship is costing them more than they're getting out of it, and they've tried everything they know to do and nothing is working. One of the very first steps you can take to help them, one of the most fun things, the most 99% most rewarding and safe things for them to do is to come up with what we call warming up behaviors. They are things the other person can do, each spouse can do for each other, that when they do that, they know they are cared about. And you can have them, we actually have a form that describes what these behaviors are supposed to be. And there are numbers, 1 through 18. You can have 5 or 10 or 15. Just give them a few to start out with. But each person fills out this piece of paper. I feel cared about when you, and then they fill in the blank. And it has to be very specific. I feel cared about when you hold my hand, when you talk to me for 5 minutes when you come home. There are some rules about what these are supposed to be. First of all, they have to be specific, that you can actually document whether it's been done or not. The behavior has to be small, not a grand gesture, just little small things that you could do frequently is another of the criteria. These behaviors are things that are small and can be easily done, and they're inexpensive. I feel cared about when you buy me a 3-carat diamond ring. Well, it's not inexpensive, and it's probably not going to happen more than once, if it happens at all. So that would not be appropriate. But I feel cared about when you bring me a fistful of daisies. Inexpensive, could happen every day, I guess, but it can happen frequently, and it needs to be worded positively. Tom's stride, he walks, takes a bigger step than I do. Rather than my saying to him, I feel cared about when you don't go off and leave me when we're walking at the mall, I say, I feel cared about when you walk beside me at the mall. So it's worded positively. And you can help couples, in the book we have a list of 100 different things. Serve dinner by candlelight. Take out the trash on your own without my asking. Make the bed. Rub my head. Ask about how my day went. There's a whole list, very specific, positively worded, easy, inexpensive things that each other can do. Now, when I do those things that are on Tom's list, they may not make any sense to me at all. But it doesn't have to matter to me. It's important if it matters to him. So what's on his list, I do that whether I think it's a big deal or not, because I care about him and I want him to know I care about him. And once couples are having their needs met in that way, first of all, it makes each of them be specific. They have to own what they want instead of griping about not getting what they want. They actually have to be specific about it and put it down. So that's a growth part there. The other person then has the option to either do it or not do it. And that's going to be another issue to live with, but that's the spontaneity of it. That old rule, if I have to tell you what I want, it's not worth it. Well, that's a dumb rule. When you want something for Christmas, you tell Santa what you want. When you want something to eat, you tell the waitress what you want or the wait person. So it's natural that if we want something from our spouse, we need to be able to verbalize it and ask for it because they can't read our mind. And so being able to do this is an excellent exercise on several levels. It makes each person responsible for letting the other person know what they want. And then when that other person does that specific behavior, you can't gripe about it anymore because you've made your list about what you want. You can add to it, change it. Some of the things won't be appropriate for public view. Other things you can put on the refrigerator. You can do this with your children as well. They can do it with their children. And everybody, when you start, when the person you're living with starts meeting some of the things that, that make you feel cared about, automatically the emotion begins to change and soften. And it opens up an atmosphere where you can talk more, where there's less arguments. You feel like you're working together. You feel more cared about. And it's just a real simple, fun exercise where everybody wins. Would you say?
Yeah, just tag that. And kind of have a flashback to an early barbecue with Jesus and his followers after his resurrection. And they're there on the beach having some barbecued fish. And he said, you know, do you love me? Well, yeah, I love you. Feed my sheep. And without getting to all the Greek grammar, he made several runs at do you love me? Well, then feed my sheep. As shepherds, I think it's an interesting thought that if you were to ask your congregants, how do you know, or what do you like, or what is it that you know, or that you can, that we can do, that you know we care about you? How do you know we care about you? My hunch is it would not only surprise you about the answers, would surprise the congregants about being asked the question. You could begin that just with your ministerial staff. As your employer, as your elders, what is it that we collectively, or maybe they've got a favorite, how do you know we care about you? And it's small, it's positive, it's inexpensive, it can happen frequently, it's not an issue of a hot topic. How do you know that we care about you? In the place where you work, wouldn't it be refreshing if somebody upstream, you know, kind of wanted to listen so that you know that that they cared about you? And they, again, could ask you that same question. The in your booklet, what I did was I took the scriptures that we've used in our book by chapter and just duplicated those for you to have. I think that it's interesting to me, sort of working in both worlds, that of training ministers and being involved in church kinds of activities, as well as in training therapists, to see the interface between our faith and what we learn, and to be able to look at the text, which, as Sandra mentioned, is, I think, the instruction manual. But to look through this for scriptures that jump out at you. I routinely have couples on whatever we're talking about on a particular point. I'd say, okay, one part of your homework is, before we meet next time, come up with the two or three verses that you think speak to this. And then let's talk about them. I very seldom will send them to a verse that I've chosen, but I'm always interested to find out where they would go to make a choice. I had a fella come in, and of course he ran straight to Ephesians 5. She needs to be in submission to me. Yes. And I just took that as an opportunity to say, well, you know, a little bit further down it says wives are to be in submission to their husband. What's your read on that? How do you think about that? Well, you know, a little bit further in that same sentence he says, you know, if you forget what it is to be a good husband, just be like Christ and die for her. What kind of thoughts have you had recently, you know, about that? It's not a pecking order just because it happened to be written linearly, but we are in mutual submission one to another. You heard mentioned sort of indirectly this morning in Randy's talk here in chapter 2, Matthew 22:34. When Jesus was asked, what's the great commandment? He didn't go to the Ten Commandments. He went to this sort of inclusive one and said, will you love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and body? And the second one is really close. Love your neighbor as yourself. Well, what's it like when you begin to treat your spouse as good as you treat your neighbor? Why would you treat your spouse worse? Why would you talk to your spouse differently in the negative sense than you would a neighbor? Sometimes with bonehead folks, I'd say, well, you're in the retail business, right? Yeah, well, what if you talk to your customers the way you talk to each other? You don't have any customers. So why would you do that that way? Matthew 6:24 is interesting in terms of mixed loyalties. This is the scripture we bring out on Budget Sunday sometimes, or when we want to, you know, talk about the offering. How do I work in today's world, dedicate the time, energy, and effort to make an income? I mean, seems to me like we all kind of have to work. My hunch is, particularly in urban societies like Houston, the majority of the husbands and wives in your congregation are dual career or dual income families. Would that be fair to say? Okay. Interesting phenomenon, usually affecting only the wife. The wife and the husband leave and go and work. Quite often, the second shift phenomenon kicks in when they return home, and she is burdened with doing all the things that she would have been doing had she been a stay-at-home wife. Does that make any sense? Rather than, we both work, now we both come home, and we both do second shift stuff. Let's say that she's a stay-at-home mom. He gets in the car, does the commute, goes to work, comes in. Is his day ended as soon as he gets back to his castle? I mean, he's put in his time. My suggestion is no. That's when he kicks into being husband and father. That's what, you know. Either that or you've got to say, no, her work starts at 6:30 and she finishes about 11:30 at night for very inadequate wages. If you want to find some really fed up, worn out ladies, it's going to be women who are doing the working outside of the home and either dual income or dual career, who come home and then are expected to do unilaterally these other kinds of things. Ask that you just understand that. You don't necessarily have to agree with that. But it's true. An interesting piece for our people in chapter 3, Luke 6, 27, that should be through 36, is how you love your enemies. Only in marriage can you sort of wake up and look on the pillow next to you and find the head of your enemy. You know, how do you pray for someone? Unfortunately, you're going to have to deal with, I think, more and more the idea of physical abuse within your congregation, spousal abuse, if you will. It'll morph over into emotional abuse, a little harder to define, or it just treats me poorly, which then people want to cash in. But the notion of physical abuse, I think theologically, you'll have to come to some sort of grips with the notion of the extent to which physical abuse is a violation of the role of the covenant of fidelity. I'm not trying to suggest to you that it's a reason for divorce or separation or legitimizing remarriage. I will say to you that when somebody comes in and has been physically abused, you're going to have to be able to take some sort of notion about how to make them safe and then what you can do to meet their spiritual needs and to deal with others. Males that abuse are usually a pretty dysfunctional individuals. And those are, I think you really need some outside help with those. But the individual may come to you because she is the victim of abuse. Most of the women will put up with that for a certain period of time until it begins to morph down into the kids, and then they're going to usually escalate. And it will usually escalate, unfortunately. I think there's an opportunity, if you go to the bottom of the second page under chapter 7, using Galatians 2 and following. When we look for characteristics of good relationships, why would we not go to the fruit of the Spirit? Can you operationalize in a marriage the fruit of the Spirit, love, joy, peace, etc.? This is part of the reason for the title of the book, that you'll notice happiness is not one of the list in the fruit of the Spirit, but joy is. The American culture believes that there is an entitlement to living happily ever after, right? That's in all of our romance literature, and they lived happily ever after. We have in our constitutional ideas the pursuit of happiness, right? Not of joy, but the pursuit of happiness. So we're a culture just dedicated, we're going to be happy or else, and if I'm not happy, it must be your fault. I've met people that wouldn't know happy if it bit them. You know, they just, you know, they wouldn't know. It'd have to knock them down. So using our 10 steps would be, if you were happy, what would it look like? A therapeutic piece for you would be, it's called the miracle question. Again, another easy question for you to ask folks. Well, Mildred, Fred, you know, if you woke up in the morning and a miracle had happened, how would things be different? If you woke up in the morning and a miracle had happened, what would be different? And then you may say, well, now, what's my next question? Well, your next question would be, I wonder how we'd get there. It's another way of getting at your goal.
I work with people who sometimes have never had very, very many good times. But you ask couples, you know, what if you woke up in the morning, how would, and things were just the way you want them to be, how would they be? And they might be able to tell you, and they say, well, I don't know, they've never been that way. Well, at what time have things been better? Well, they were better, so and so and so and so. So then help them figure out what to do to make that situation happen more often. And so it's, if they don't have a memory of things being like they really want them to be, how have they in the past been at least better than they are now? And go from there with them. Because pretty much everybody has had some place where, or they know what they would like for it to be.
It's a whole lot easier. I don't know if you've been to SeaWorld or not and seen Shamu or some of these trained animals. One of the things, the approaches that I use is that I have this fantasy that Shamu wasn't given a set of instructions and once having then accomplished all of these behavioral tasks was given a sardine. If I know anything about behavioral shaping, it's like, you know, look this way, you'll get a sardine. So over time, you teach people to do stuff. I don't think spouses necessarily like to be thought of as being in training for some sort of circus performing act. But I'll tell you this, there's nothing like the power of a nice, kind word in shaping you in that particular direction. Just say thank you. You don't have to do 30 minutes on explaining. You know, say, I really liked it when you did. So if you like picking up clothes, I remember somebody that I was married to saying, you know, that was really nice. Like, what? You know, I thought God made doorknobs for hanging things on. It seemed to be functional to me rather than other things. They're hung up, they're not on the floor. But you'll have couples that want to do, you know, head-to-head warfare. I like guerrilla stuff a little bit better. You just go, thank you, dear. Really felt cared about when that happened. And then you walk on and do that. I know we haven't answered all of your questions. We're going to hang around for a little bit if you've got a specific question. And I wish you Godspeed as you love your couples. Let's close with a prayer. Father, we thank you for the opportunity to be in people's lives, and we pray that we'll always be a positive influence for them. We would like, we think, the opportunity to speak with them before they do dumb things, that we can be there as guides rather than always coming to the rescue. We're glad to rescue, but we really would like to save folks from doing things that are not good for them or good for others. We're glad that we can be there after things blow up, but we'd really like to be there before a fuse is even lit. Father, we ask you to help us be your people and to let that rub off on those with which we live. Thank you, Father, for loving us. In your Son's name we pray. Amen.